Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. I am so pleased today to welcome back number one New York Times bestselling author James Rollins. It's always a great conversation with James, and this time it's kind of exciting because he's done something a little different. We're talking about today his first ever anthology of short stories, which includes an all-new full-length novella. The book is called Unrestricted Access. James introduces every story in the book with a little background and shares why he wrote it, which I always find fascinating. Today, we touch on several of those short stories, including standalone stories, as well as some familiar characters. James shares the difference between short story and novella writing versus the epics that he usually works on. And we explore some of his research into locations and the myths surrounding them. James also tells us why, when the legendary George R.R. Martin invited him to write a short story featuring a warrior, he developed a four-legged warrior in The Pit. And he tells that story from the viewpoint of that four-legged warrior. Very interesting. James Rollins is the number one New York Times bestselling author of international thrillers. His writing has been translated into more than 40 languages, sold more than 20 million books, and as I said, his first anthology of short stories with novella is Unrestricted Access. And here's my guest, James Rollins. James Rollins, welcome. Welcome back.
Thank you, Vicki. Always happy to be on your program.
Well, it's kind of exciting to have a book of short stories from you today. You know, I knew this was coming because we talked about a little bit about it last time. But for people who weren't expecting an anthology from you, let's just share why you wanted to do this.
Well, I've been writing short fiction since the beginning of my career up until even the new novella that's included in the anthology. But over the course of the year, you know, a lot of the stories sort of fade away. Some were just ebook originals. Some were in anthologies that are no longer in print, so they're hard to find. But there were, you know, ghosts of those references in on the internet. People were inquiring via email. Hey, you know, I heard of this story of yours called The Pit. You know, is that a novel? You know, I'm a James Rollins completist. I must have everything. Where can I find this book? And I'd have to then they said, oh, you know, it's a short story. It's in this anthology. It's hard to find, blah, 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 blah. So I entertained enough of those emails that I finally just sort of in a conversation with my editor said, hey, you know, I was wondering, you know, I've done these few short stories over the years, and I thought of maybe just, you know, putting them together in a little chapbook, maybe something we can just, you know, do really as like maybe an ebook original just to put out there for people that are inquiring about it. She said, well, that's a good idea. Why don't you send me all of your short stories that have been previously published? So I did, and I realized there was more than I thought. I had forgotten how many short stories I had actually written. So when I submitted them to my editor, she goes, you know, this, you've got a short story. This is about the same length of one of your Sigma novels. This is in a little short little chapbook.
Right, right.
So, you know, why don't we do, you know, a proper release? You know, would you be willing to do an introduction? I said, of course, yeah, I'd love to introduce the anthology. And so when I was writing the introduction, I thought, you know, I just realized that in course of all of these short stories, they're almost like a roadmap of my career, from the beginning of my career to present day. And so I started doing introductions to many of the short stories within the anthology to basically use them as a sort of a way for me to look back at the arc of my career, but also maybe to share a little insight on how, you know, that veterinarian became an author, my trials and tribulations along that path, you know, why did I tell this short story now, what might I have done different, and use it almost as like a little a roadmap of my career. But of course, I also didn't want to just sell old material, so I decided to write a brand new novella, sort of a mini novel featuring Tucker and Kane that's also included with the anthology to make it sort of an extra special package. So that's how Unrestricted Access came about.
Right. And I want to begin with the novella, if we can. I love that with all of the stories throughout the book that you do that introduction to them, because as you said, it does give you some insight. And I mean, I'm imagining it was somewhat of a thrill to put this together. I'm hoping it wasn't a nightmare for you.
Well, it was a great deal of fun, because I got to look back. You know, I got to reread stories that I hadn't actually looked at in 2 decades. And my editor said, "Hey, Jim, would you want to update any of these stories or refresh them or repolish them?" And I considered it because, you know, as any author, I think we always have this internal editor going on in our head that we're always wanting, we're never satisfied with our work. We always think, you know, eventually there's a deadline, we have to turn it in, but we resist that, we cling on it with, you know, with tight fists because we don't want to let it go until we think it's absolutely perfect. So it was tempting to be able to do a polish on those. But I also then thought, you know what, I wanted to sort of show, if I'm going to truly say this is an arc of my career, you know, I wanted to be able to show this is how I was writing, you know, 22 years ago. And the new novella is how I'm writing today. So you can sort of see, you know, if I try to polish that up, then there might be uniformity that you're not going to appreciate exactly that arc that I'm trying to describe within the anthology.
Right. Well, the anthology is called Unrestricted Access, as I said in the intro. The novella is called Sun Dogs, and it does feature two of your known characters in here, Tucker and Kane. And I read somewhere that you wanted to include them because at some point they're going to be appearing in a future Sigma book, and you wanted to reintroduce them to your audience.
Correct. I mean, they first appeared as a short story. You know, I wrote them basically because I had done a trip to Iraq and Kuwait and saw these military handlers with their war dogs working the fields, and I was really intrigued by that relationship. I wanted to capture them on paper, but I didn't want to just write from one end of that leash, from the soldier's side of the leash. I also wanted to go to the other side of the leash and write scenes from the point of view of the four-legged soldier, the dog. And so I tested that with the short story that's tracked, that's featured in the anthology. Eventually, I spun them off into the Sigma universe with Bloodline and then even into their own individual adventures. But again, with Sun Dogs, I'm sort of revisiting a past trauma. It's basically a major source of PTSD for Tucker, and this is sort of a resolution of some of that pain from his years out in Afghanistan. And I also, like you said, they are reappearing, and you don't have a long wait. They'll be in my very next Sigma novel, Kingdom of Bones.
Oh, good.
Next spring, so you will be seeing them reappear. This is a little refresher, so you can visit Tucker and Kane a little bit before they're pulled into a grand big adventure with Sigma Force.
Right. Well, one of the things I always love about your books is the back of the book where you put the fact versus fiction, and you just mentioned post-traumatic stress disorder and Tucker. And one of the things you talk about there is that there's another topic has been raised in the story with the new understanding of one aspect of PTSD, and that's moral injury. And I've not heard of that. Would you share with us what you learned about that?
That's a relatively new term. It's a redefinition of PTSD in regards to, you know, post-traumatic stress appears in many different, it's a chimera. It appears in many different formats. But there's one format that seems to be undiagnosed and unappreciated, and that's moral injury. It's where a soldier is faced with choices out in the field that literally sort of damages that internal compass that points you in the right direction. It's your true north. It's your sense of morality. And in the theater of war, oftentimes that is damaged. And when they come back, they have a hard time, you know, realigning that true north inside them. And that's something that Tucker is struggling with. And it's a reflection of something I learned from talking to. I learned actually about moral injury from going to Bethesda Naval Hospital just prior to going to my trip to Iraq and Kuwait, where I learned about the various aspects of PTSD. And I just thought it was underappreciated. I thought, you know, this is an aspect that most people don't know about.
Right.
About the damage that can occur from a morality that has a deep resounding effects afterwards.
Which makes perfect sense when you think about it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, so the location in Sundogs is one of my favorite spots. You base it in Arizona, in Sedona, and around the desert around there, because it has a character all of its own.
Yep.
I think you've written about that in a previous novel, if I'm correct. But why did you want to set it there?
Well, again, I often get the question, do you research? Do you travel a lot for your research? And I actually seldom do. It's very rare that I will be writing a novel. Let's say it's that takes place in Paris, so I'm going to fly out to Paris, run around Paris, get my notes, come back, and continue to work on the novel. Usually I just travel for the fun of it. And I was in Sedona. And again, I had set the Devil Colony is set in that area. It's set in the a little further to the south of Sedona in New Mexico and Arizona. And I've always liked that. Those areas always sort of speak to me a little bit, the red rocks, the dramatic landscape. So I just went there for vacation. And I was doing a Jeep tour, and the Jeep tour director was this former Marine, big, burly guy, a little bit long-haired, very gruff. And he's leading this Jeep tour out into the back country outside of Sedona. And, I raised the question about, these vortexes or the vortices that people talk about being located, these sort of energetic nexuses people seem to have a sensitivity to. And so I was asking him about that, and he was saying, when I first moved here, 15 years ago, I thought that was all, just, basically he says, to quote him, he says, I didn't believe anything those crystal munchers were saying.
I love that line, the crystal munchers.
I wrote it down, and it appears in the story, because that's actually from a quote from that guy that is used in the book.
Right,
in the novella.
Right.
And that's why, it just struck with me. It just stuck with me. And then he said, then I, after a while, I was here maybe 5 or 6 years. I was out with some buddies out into the desert, and all of a sudden, all of us had sort of prickling, goose fleshy type of feeling, and none of us were originally going to admit it. But then, eventually we just couldn't deny it, and we just all of a sudden realized we're all feeling this. And so after that, he's a true believer. So I liked that character. I thought that was a very interesting moment with this gentleman. And so I just sort of put it in the back of my mind, and I thought at some point I'm going to, I want to revisit that. And so when I was trying to think of a story to feature Tucker and Cain, I thought this is the perfect chance to use that location and that little anecdote that gentleman shared with me.
Right, right. Now, you mentioned The Pit, one of the 12 short stories that you have in the anthology, and that's another story involving a dog named Brutus. And I read that you wanted to impress George R.R. Martin, and so you wrote this story of a warrior, but not a human warrior. So tell us about that, James.
Well, when George R. R. Martin invites you to write a short story novella for his anthology, you're not going to say no. And the conceit of his anthology was that he was asking all these submitters to tell stories from the viewpoint of a warrior. It could be a warrior in present day, the past, the future. They just wanted to have some type of aspect of being a warrior. And now, being a veterinarian, I thought, why don't I write a story from the point of view of a dog? A dog in a dog fighting ring, that's a warrior. And so it becomes a sort of harrowing tale of a puppy that's kidnapped, that's brutalized into the pit fighting rings, and sort of a redemptive story of how that dog is healed. Again, it was almost my first foray into writing an alien, so to speak, point of view, a non-human point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that experience that when I came to writing Tucker and Cain later on, almost a decade later, I was almost prepared for that. I was, I enjoyed writing The Pit, and so being able to write from the other side of the leash with this dynamic duo of the handler and his dog, I was sort of ready, set to do that.
Yeah, it's not an easy story. I mean, was it difficult for you to write? Because you are a veterinarian, and I know you've got dogs that you love. Was it difficult to write that?
It was very difficult. Again, I had to do some research with the, in that whole venue, speaking to animal control officers about their experiences in breaking up these dog fighting rings, hearing anecdotes of how these rings acquire not just their dog fighting, but they also they will collect dogs they use basically just to feed or to bait their dogs at training. So a lot of the techniques, the training techniques that are shown at the beginning of that novella are based on fact. Those are real things that are done to train these dogs for the ring.
Yeah. I heard a story when I was a child that traumatized me, and I hate reading stuff about dogs now. I don't know if you might be familiar with it since you've done so much research over the years, but it's the legend of Llewellyn the Great in northern Wales. It was in the 12th, 13th century, I forget now, but he had this wonderful dog named Galette, and they went everywhere together, but he had a new baby, left the dog at home in charge of the baby, goes hunting, comes back, finds blood everywhere. The dog rushes up to him. He's got blood dripping from his mouth, and he thinks he's killed the baby. And so he plunges a sword into him. And as the dog gives out his dying cry, the baby starts crying. It's under the cradle that's been tipped over in the bloody blankets, and there's a dead wolf there. And it's, that story so traumatized me when I was a kid. I still can't read stories about animals.
Exactly. I mean, it's again, I didn't want to end on a horrible, horrible note. Now, if there's a redemptive quality to the pit, you know, I'm going to pick you up a little bit after I knock you off your feet with that story. But again, I think we've all, you know the story of Old Yeller. Again, another traumatic story of a boy and his dog. I'm a big fan of Richard Adams, who did Watership Down, but he also did
Plague Dogs,
yeah. Which is just, again, that's a hard read.
That was a very hard read. I read all of it, but it was a very hard read.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, again, this is a little bit my harking back to Richard Adams, a little bit harking back to my own veterinary career and crafting that story.
Yeah, but it's a great story. It is a great story. So let's switch gears. Let's look at one that's, you were asked to write young adult fantasy for an anthology, which resulted in Tagger. And that's a story about a teenage street artist, which has kind of a different flair to it. So tell us a little about that one.
Well, I like to share that because it's, you know, it's a very different. You know, most people who read James Rollins expecting a staccato paced thriller, these harrowing adventures. But there's a part of me, you know, from early in my career, I was doing writing fantasy novels under a different pen name. I was writing a thriller a year and a fantasy novel a year. So there's that aspect of my enjoyment of reading. And I think every writer should be writing from a point of passion. And I love to read fantasy, so I was dabbling with fantasy. So when R.L. Stine approached me to do a story for his anthology, you know, I was very happy to do a little fantasy-esque story, more towards the young adult crowd. You know, I did a fantasy-esque middle school series featuring Jake Ransom back a few years ago. So it was nice going back and, you know, touching bases with that side of my writing persona.
Right, right. And one I want to talk about too is the Devil's Bones for a couple of reasons. You co-wrote that with Steve Berry, and I've talked with him several times too. I don't know if I ever told you this, James, but I went to once when I interviewed Steve Berry, he was putting a workshop on in Seattle, and he said, "Come along, I'll leave a free pass for you." And so I went to the workshop, and you showed up and gave a little talk there. And
okay, I remember that.
Yeah, I have to say it was one of the best workshops I'd ever been to. It was really informative and entertaining. And yeah, so I was kind of thrilled to see that you guys had written The Devil's Bones together. And I'm wondering how that came together and how it all worked.
Well, Steve Berry and I have been friends. We sort of, grew up in the ranks together. You know, we both started our career about the same time. Steve Berry had published Amber Room, his first book, a little bit after my book came out. And so he had read Subterranean and Excavation, my first couple novels, and approached me to do a blurb for Amber Room. And I was very excited to do so because at that point, very few people had asked me to do a blurb for my novel. And I had gotten tremendous blurbs from other authors that were very generous with their time and words. So I was happy to do so. So I read The Amber Room, loved it, gave him a blurb. Skip forward 6 months, book comes out. Unbeknownst to me, Steve Berry had gotten another author to also give him a blurb. Someone that wasn't as popular as me at that time. It was a relatively unknown author. It was Dan Brown. And so Dan Brown had given him a blurb before Da Vinci Code ever hit the shelves.
Good company.
So unsurprisingly, emblazoned across the front cover of The Amber Room is this wonderful blurb from Dan Brown. You know, if you, you know, love the book, you know, Steve's a great writer, or Dan Brown, you flip to the back, you look over the, you know, the UPC code at the back of the cover in very tiny letters, I liked it too, James Rollins. I've been friends ever since.
I love it.
We occasionally would make little nods, little, you know, winks at each other in the our books. You know, I'd mention my, you know, tangentially mention one of his characters, or maybe the bookshop where Cotton works, or, you know, Tucker, I mean, you know, Cotton would mention something about Gray and Company. And so we share an audience, so eventually we thought that was little nods just to ourselves, but readers also picked up on that, and they began to start this rumor that James Rollins and Steve Barry were the same person. That we were, this was a secret nod to the audience, signaling that we were actually the same writer.
Oh, how interesting.
Pen names. So eventually we had to do a tour, prove that we're two different people. You know, so again, the questions will come up in his audience and my audience, you know, hey, you know, James, or hey, Steve, you know, why don't you two collaborate on a work? And we would love to. We've talked about it many, many times. But the problem is that he's with a different publisher than I am. A publisher is very possessive of our brands, and if we did a collaborative project, I think there'd be a major war in New York City over who's going to publish that combined work. But when the this anthology that was in support of supporting ITW, the International Thriller Writers, came about, we thought, well, this is a perfect opportunity. They can't complain if we do a short story together. So this was our chance for us to do what readers were clamoring for, which is to introduce Cotton, Malone, and Gray Pierce in a little jungle adventure, and that's The Devil's Bones.
Yeah. And so how did you manage the writing together? I mean, I'm guessing you guys, like, had video conferences or stuff. Did you take it, section by section, scene by scene? How did that work?
Exactly. Basically, we outlined it together via phone and via, I don't think we Skyped anything. It was just phone. And then I worked on the point of view from Gray. He did it with the point of view of Cotton, and then we sort of jiggered it all together, and then we sort of multiple times reread and reworked each other's sections, mostly because we were trying to figure out who was going to be the bigger hero. Gave a little competition. You know, Gray was coming off a little bit too strong in this story, Jim. You know, I need Cotton to step forward a little stronger. Okay, go ahead. And then, no, Cotton's too much in the spotlight. I need Gray to come back. So it took a while to get that balance.
Yeah, it's collaboration is always interesting, I think. And if you get a great collaborative partner, I mean, that's magic.
So yeah, collaboration is definitely a weird bird. You know, I've done some collaborative work with a wonderful award-winning author, Rebecca Cantrell, in my Sanguine series, and I worked with Grant Blackwood on spinning Tucker and Kane into their series. And you know, generally when I've done 38 books, and most times I'm the judge, jury, and executioner of all my work. Mm. When you're working with a partner, then you're writing by committee, so there's some back and forth, there's some restraint, you have to learn to speak to each other and how to communicate in regards to editing. That's a whole hurdle to get over. But also, the wonderful thing, though, is that you've got two minds to solve every problem. You know, I'm notorious for painting my characters into a corner. It will sometimes take me days to figure out how to get them out of the corner, whereas I can, you know, call Rebecca or call Grant, and we can, you know, workshop our way through that situation. So that was great. You know, I think what's best about collaborative work is I think the final product, if it's done well, is better than what either author could have done by themselves.
Yes, the sum of the parts. Yeah, great. So last time we talked about the Odyssey, and we spent a couple of minutes at the end of our conversation talking about the difference between actually writing short stories and a novel. When you're looking at a novella, how do you approach that differently? Because this one is about 47 pages, if I remember correctly.
Right. It's about twice the length of any of the other stories that are in the anthology, so it's a big, chunky story. And it is a different bird. I mean, it definitely, again, in the sort of introduction, I talk about a teacher, one of my English teachers, that was describing the difference between writing a novel, writing a short story, and writing a poetry, is that, you know, each stage you step down, you get less words in which to tell your story and to evoke the proper emotion. And so you go from novel, where you have to trim out all the subplots and the tangents down to get to a very streamlined short story, and then to get, you know, even to take out more words, get to that poem that has that emotional response you want. So it's different. It's a different skill set. When I was first learning to write, I wrote a bunch of short fiction because that's all I thought I could fit within my day job. I had a very busy clinic that was running.
Yeah.
I had cracks in time to write. I thought all I can fill in those cracks of times is short stories. So I tried writing short stories, and nothing ever got published. It was rather discouraging. I think for 4 years I was writing, I think, probably a good 24 short stories. Stuff that's now safely buried in my backyard. I'm not going to make anybody read them. But I submitted a short story to a magazine called Realms of Fantasy. It was a magazine created and edited by Marion Zimmer Bradley, who did Mists of Avalon. It's probably her most famous novel. And she had sent me a note back, said, "Hey, Jim, you know, I can tell from reading your short story that you have the chops to be a writer, to be a good writer. But reading your short story, I can see that you're sort of you're trying to elbow your way out of the restraints of a short story. I just feel like your brain is wired as a novelist." And I got to thinking about that. I could have taken her advice in two ways. Either she was telling me this because she wanted to shift me to write a novel so that I would stop writing these bad short stories that I was submitting to her
right.
for a loan, or maybe she was right. Now, and I realized that, you know, actually I prefer generally to read novels versus short stories, so I do read many, many short stories, but I prefer novels, and the fatter the novel, the better. If it's a doorstopper, great. If it's a part of a series, even better. So, you know, maybe that is the way my mind is wired. So I began working on my first novel, and I ended up surprisingly selling. And then, again, I've got offers to write these short stories, and it was a struggle for me to go back to trying to confine this wild beast in my mind into the confinement of a short story. Now, when it came to doing a novella, I had a little more elbow room. You know, I can structure it more like a mini-novel, as I described earlier. It is a short story in regards that it's only, you know, 40 to 50 pages long, but at the same time, I sort of structured almost like a three-act little mini-novel. So that felt more comfortable to me, even though it was in short story format or in a shorter format. Because I had a little bit more elbow room, it was a more comfortable fit.
Mm. Well, I think the timing for this unrestricted access to your anthology is perfect, because I've talked with so many people, and I've heard from friends and colleagues that who are avid readers normally, and they say, "I just can't keep reading a book." So, you know, short stories maybe will be the way to get through this pandemic for a while.
Yeah, they're what's nice about short stories is that it's a limited commitment. You know, whether it's a short subway ride, you can potentially get a short story read, or maybe you're making a short jaunt to the grocery store and you're listening to an audio. You know, it's not requiring the full commitment of staying for the long journey of a novel. You know, it's basically just a short trip. So to distract you, get you escape, let you, you know, at least temporarily forget 2020.
Absolutely. And I want to ask you, we're almost at the end of our segment here, but I want to take some time here just to ask you how Duncan is doing, your dog. I saw on Instagram that he had the same surgery my dog had 7 weeks ago. So how is he doing?
He's doing well. He just had for those that don't know, he had his spleen removed. He has, which is common in golden retrievers, he had a hemangiosarcoma, which is a very aggressive, very malignant cancer. Prognosis is generally very few dogs make it to a year. Most have come within 6 months. So I've got him on I did a bunch of research as a veterinarian and as a novelist. Found out there was a new study being done at the University of Minnesota, and I'm using a new research protocol on Duncan here. My prognosis is guardedly optimistic, but it has to stay pretty guarded because it is a pretty aggressive cancer. But otherwise, he's in good spirits. He's happy. He's recovered well. He seems oblivious of it, and that's my goal, is keep him as happy and unaffected as I can for as long as possible.
Yes, mine too. So are you going to be writing about that a little bit? I saw you put the question out there.
Yeah, I'll keep people updated, because I do get a lot of inquiries about how he's doing, so I will definitely, through social media, keep people abreast on how things are going. But so far, so good. Of course, it's only been a month post-op, so still early in the arc of this.
Yeah, well, my dog had his spleen out 7 weeks ago, he's gone back in time a few years. He seems younger and brighter, so I'm hoping for the best on that. All right, so
yeah, it's, they are kids. It's hard to.
Oh, it's unbearable. I can't even go there. I have to keep, you know, that thought in very short frames.
And a lot of times talking to oncologists, veterinary oncologists, and talking to, you know, people doing different studies on golden retrievers across the U.S. So, and probably bothering a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's always such a pleasure to talk to you. And as I said at the beginning, it's exciting to have all these short stories and the novella from you. Final thought you'd like to leave listeners with? I know they can find out more about you at jamesrollins.com. What would you like to leave listeners with today, James?
Oh, just a reminder that Kingdom of Bones, the next thriller, is coming out next spring. It's all about viruses.
Oh,
not that I was planning on this. You know, I pitched this idea well before COVID ever struck, but it's not so much a pandemic novel, because I've done pandemic novels in the past. The Sixth Extinction, the Seventh Plague were all sort of pandemic novels. This is more about, it features a veterinarian that's a virus hunter out in Africa. So it's basically a
Is this your alter ego?
Virus hunting.
Is this your alter ego, since he's a vet?
Pretty close. I don't want to reveal too much on how that overlaps, but I will tell you next spring, Vicki, and how much I'm drawing on my own life.
Well, we will look forward to that, James. And meanwhile, all the best, and thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.